Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we are talking about the North again. We're returning to Northern Ireland, and this time we're actually taking it from a loyalist perspective. Martin, that's one of your favourite aspects of the world, is looking at it through the alternative lens, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, borders in the general sense, we fight over borders, Tony, but they're only imaginary lines on a piece of paper. They don't actually exist. You know, they don't.
Borders in the mind.
Borders in the mind. The borders are in the mind, I think, far more than they are physically.
The one issue I always have is that people, when I say to people that I'm an open borders kind of loon, they always, you know, because that's that awful question you get. You know, if you say that, you're just going to create a pull factor and invite immigrants and all. I'm like, yeah. Anyway, look, we are, much more importantly, we are delighted to be joined by Dr. Garrett Mulvenna from, he's a historian of the Troubles, and he's the writer of the book on the Tartan Gangs as well. Garrett, you came highly recommended. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me. Pleased to be here.
I must mention, you also have your own podcast, Hidden Histories of the Troubles in Northern Ireland, isn't it?
Yeah, it's sort of, it's not as prolific as this one. I think I've done maybe 9 episodes over 2.5 years, but yeah. People seem to enjoy it. It's more, you know, it's a document of social history during that period, and it's got a few good talking heads there to tell their stories. It's more a sort of extension of the oral history sort of work I would have done rather than the regular podcast. But yeah, it seems to have gone well, but far from prolific.
Yeah, well, look, I just thought it'd be, might as well get the plug in at the beginning while people are still listening to me. But you wrote an interesting piece, given the flare-ups in the violence and the things that we've seen. And it just going to give the headline, it was Young Loyalists Need to Listen to Those Who Experienced the Worst of the Troubles. And then you talked about in 1972 how, you know, BBC were there and they were asking about the sectarian rioting and how a new youth subculture movement was developing on the streets in Protestant working class districts. And straight away, you hear the echoes of the past and what's happening today. Do you want to just give us a sense of, first of all, the piece itself, why you saw that and what lessons we should be learning?
Yeah, thanks. And thanks for taking the time to read it. So just a brief overview. I mean, I did my PhD at Queen's University Belfast finished it in 2009. It was on the Protestant working class in Belfast from pre-Troubles post-conflict. Then I subsequently wrote the book on the Tartan Gangs, and more recently did the autobiography with Billy Hutchinson. So basically, you know, when this all kicked off, I actually remember the night that it kicked off. I live in North Belfast along the Antrim Road, and I was getting my daughter ready for bed. She's 4 years old. And she said, "Daddy, why is Tesco on fire?" Now, obviously, the fire was at Lanark Way, which was a couple of miles away, but there were plumes of smoke billowing up behind the Tesco near our house. So I never thought I'd have to have a conversation like this with my 4-year-old daughter, because, you know, we're in the year 2021. Basically, what I saw on the streets, you know, was worrying. I don't think it bears comparison with the early 70s, but I felt compelled to write a piece. And it was for The Guardian initially, because I'd written to The Guardian around the time of the flag protests. And I thought it would give him maybe a different viewpoint, a historical long view. Unfortunately, I didn't get any response from The Guardian or any of the mainstream British newspapers. So instead of, you know, and also I've thought about it in the blog, didn't get a response from the Belfast Telegraph either. I'm not sure what the story is there. So I decided just to post it in the blog, because people seem to read the blog and there's good readership. What I wanted to do was look at what happened in the early 70s with guys who were this age, you know, between the age of, I'd say, 11 and 12 and 16, 17, and see if there were any parallels with the sort of disorder that we saw a few weeks ago. And more importantly, were the voices of those young people who were in the Tartan Gangs at the time, who are now, you know, people like Billy Hutchinson, who've gone through violence, prison, politics. Is there any lessons could be learned from them? Now, the worrying thing that I was hearing was that the older generation on both sides of the sectarian divide weren't being listened to by the young people. And one of the points somebody made to me on Facebook, which I find quite chilling, and I think it's quite important for people to hear this, look at the early 70s. You know, you had the IRA violence, you had bombs on the Shankill, you had feeling that this was, I mean, the inflammatory language that was being used by politicians at the time, and also church leaders, where they talked about this being the ultra-Protestant community's high noon. And that's very evocative language. And then you have the proroguing of Stormont. But basically, I'm not sure if this bears any comparison with what's going on at the moment. But something somebody said on Facebook that I found really chilling was that if you look at that early 70s period and you look at young loyalists and you had people saying you have to go out and defend your community, if you give a young man like that a gun, it's dangerous. If you give a young man in the same scenario on the Shankill, you know, in the year 2021, a gun, it's even more dangerous, because back in 1972, these young people had something to believe in, whereas now they don't have anything to believe in. You know, so it's a worrying time, I think, and it's pretty unstable.
Gareth, the differences between the 70s and now, is it that there is a vacuum in politics now, and that into this vacuum is spilling these feelings of being left behind, these feelings of being excluded from wider society? That's what we're hearing here in the South. Does that bear up north? Is that the same narrative?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a vacuum in political leadership for the loyalist working class. But I don't think the political leadership was any better in the early 70s.
We're going to interrupt the podcast now because we have to. The Tortoise Shack, if you're following us on social media, if you're aware of what we do, you're also aware of how we are hand to mouth. It's been a difficult few months. That's no secret. Many of our listeners are aware of it. Many of our listeners know how things have been. But the reality is things are difficult across the board for a lot of people. We are no different. If we fail, I'm not actually worried that we made a difference. We tried, but let's go out swinging, Martin.
Yeah, I agree with you, Tony. Look, it's a lot of people have lost a lot during COVID, and we completely understand. And we, for the first 6 months, we kind of wrote it out, and we said we'll be fine. But the longer it's gone on, the more the writing is on the wall for us. Unless we get patrons, we're stuck in this model, and we can't move forward. So it's patrons we need. If we don't get them, we're just going to have to pull the plug. And it's that simple. And we hate saying it, but we're being honest about it.
Like 2 quarters of negative growth in terms of stuff like that, it's putting my evil banker hat on. That's a recession.
Yeah, it is.
And we're now 7 months down.
Yeah, it is. And, we try to make a difference. I suppose politics is not sexy for everybody.
I think we've made a difference. I hate to say that. If we fail, we failed going out on our shield.
I agree with you. Yeah, we need people to sign up, Tony. It's the only way we can keep this project going. I mean, it's very difficult, and you know it's very difficult. But the amount of work we've put into it, we're just not taking anything out of it at all.
I know. And again, I'm proud of the work, Martin. I'm proud of what's happened. And if it all fell apart, it fell apart because we tried, and something else will, something like, it's not like we're irreplaceable. We're not. But I do think we will go out and we make these pleas and we'll say, people, if you have the price of a cup of coffee, it's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. If you think that the work has value, whether it's Glow West, it's Reboot, it's the two Norries, it's all of the stuff that we bring into you. I was talking to another young law student today about an upcoming podcast that we were hoping to launch. I have all these plans for all of these things, but it just can't happen because
we are stymied by our funding, Tony, and we need to open up our funding so that we can do more and more.
And it's well worth it, by the way. The content that's behind the paywall, as you say, there's buckets of it. So yeah, we try to make it work. If we go down swinging, and I'm going down swinging. So if you are listening, you're getting something out of it, put your hands in your pockets and make us actually feel that it's worthwhile. Keep on going. Yeah. Patreon.com/tortoiseshack. We'll let you go back to the podcast. I feel exasperated, but off we go.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely a vacuum in political leadership for the loyalist working class. But I don't think the political leadership was any better in the early 70s. I mean, you listen to Arlene Foster at the time when the bus was burnt out on the Shankill. And, you know, she said it was, you know, she condemned it, but also
she condemned it and said, but the real.
Yeah, exactly. That's the point. Yeah, what the real lawbreakers are, Sinn Féin. And you know, it's not the same degree to what was being said in the early 70s. But you know, in the early 70s, you always had a fragmentation in unionism and loyalism, where you had, you know, liberal unionists like O'Neill being displaced by more angry voices, and then you had the emergence of the Vanguard movement, which was a sort of, I suppose at the time, it was regarded as a proto-fascist organization in terms of, you had Bill Craig coming to the rallies, monster rallies in an open-top touring car and accompanied by motorcycle outriders. And he said at that famous rally in March 1972 that if we're not protected, you know, if the politicians fail, it'll be our job to liquidate the enemy. And what he was basically saying was, you know, because at that stage, Bill Craig would have had very close relationships with new organizations like the Red Hand Commando, the UDA. So he was basically giving young people a green light. So there was never really, since the start of the Troubles, there's never really been anything but a political vacuum or bad political leadership. Not to get too far ahead of myself, but you look at parties like the PUP and the Ulster Democratic Party that came about in the 90s. And I was talking about this on Twitter recently. You know, how different would things have been if people like Gary McMichael had been allowed to, you know, develop a political project and not been sidelined by people like Johnny Adair and John White in the background? And what would it have been like for Billy Hutchinson and David Irvine if there hadn't been the LVF in the background and there hadn't been sort of, you know, dirty tricks going on to sort of subvert their message? It might be a different picture now.
But Gareth, we see the thing is that the counterfactual. The problem is, we've spoken to, for example, you know, Brian Smith. We've spoken to Emma D'Souza. We've spoken to Kula Yasuma, the Commissioner for Children and Young People, and they've all kind of said the similar things as well. And you point to it in your piece that there's also a huge economic instability. There's an economic inequality, and you point to the fact that some of these, I'm going to use that dreaded word, estates, you know, these areas, they haven't come on, as we would say, you know, socioeconomic, social mobility, educational attainment. Yeah. All of these things probably make it a fertile ground for that kind of, and this is, again, this is me, big. I can hear Brian in my head telling me, save your Free State nonsense, hot takes, yeah. Groves. But nonetheless, you know, are we looking at this, you know, is this what we're really facing? Is really inequality is the breeding ground for this?
It's inequality and sectarianism. I mean, in any other society, that inequality would be challenged more broadly, whereas if you look back here, you know, to the sort of outdoor relief strikes back at the beginning of the 20th century, you know, working class people did come together to protest against unemployment. But it was at that time, it was the unionist elite who tried to focus the Protestant workers' mind on the sectarian aspect. I think it's important, you know, I was talking to a guy who had interviewed for the Tartan book, Robert Niblock, a few weeks ago, and he made a fantastic point. You know, in the parallels where he said, if you look at his squad of Tartan members who joined the Red Hand Commando in 1972, there would have been a sort of, basically when they came out of school, or when the day he left school when he was 15, he could have walked into any of six jobs. Now, his feeling is that if you look at the young fellas in Lanark Way, probably none of them are working or in education or, you know, engaged in that type of thing. Another important point that people outside, you know, the North might not realise or might not have considered is that if you look at urban redevelopment in Shankill in the 70s, there was definitely a plan there to break up working class communities. That's not just the Shankill, it's other, you know, Catholic working class areas. Communities were broken up and a lot of people were moved out to, you know, places like Rathcoole, where there was court halls and new industry. But the problem, and it was Billy Hutchinson was making this point, they remind me of this last week, you move a massive skilled workforce out to the sort of suburbs and you leave an urban neighbourhood like Shankill absolutely decimated, where thousands of people have left. And what you're left is with an aging population, and you're left with an unskilled population. And it goes back to what, you know, you guys were talking about with Smitty, about the intergenerational trauma. This is intergenerational hopelessness and disillusion. Now, one of the things I looked at in my thesis when I was doing the PhD was, where did this all start? Why do people vote along sectarian lines rather than class lines? Well, for me, one of the big glaring factors would be, if you look at the early 70s, if you look at how loyalism responded, you know, people talk about defending Ulster, defending Northern Ireland, and we hear about, you know, Ulster not being sold out, and the idea of the protocol and the sea border affecting people's identity and culture. But at the base of it all, and I've heard this a couple of times recently, when you hear people like Stacey Graham and other, you know, new loyalist voices talking about what loyalism means to them, they talk about loyalism means loyalty to the community. And I think in the early 70s period, and that's why, another reason why you have so many fractures within loyalism, loyalty was to your street. Now, people were standing at the top of their street, defending the street, not the Shankill Road per se. They were defending Mayo Street, Berlin Street, you know, whatever street they lived on. And then that all came together, you know, in terms of the UDA or the UVF or whatever. But, you know, there was never really, I think people were so focused on defending what they had or what they perceived that they had, which wasn't a lot, which is recognized now, that they never really thought about what they wanted. And, you know, David Irvine made that point where he said, you know, opposition to the Good Friday Agreement is based on what we don't want, but it's not based on what we do want. So, you know, it's very difficult to sort of get out of that myopic vision where people are constantly having to defend
an
ideology.
The view from the rest of Great Britain is, and in recent surveys we've seen this, that they don't want Northern Ireland. They see it as a liability.
Yeah.
Oh, well so, no, hang on. No, I will let you go back in, Martin, but ITV's journalist Peston pointed out quite well that there's a lot of swing voters up for grabs here. You know, the people who vote DUP might swing to Sinn Féin and this kind of nonsense.
But it begs the question, is loyalism... The loyalism that we see on the ground, that we see in the riots, as you've said, it's loyalism to your street, even to your next door neighbours. But is it essentially loyalism to the British Crown? Is there a medium way there where there's some path through that it can be resolved without coming to a fist fight?
I mean, that's an interesting one. It's a sort of debate you could have all day, really, about, you know, loyalism and what it means. Loyalty to the Crown is obviously... I mean, I remember talking to Billy Mitchell, who was a member of the UVF and became a conflict transformation advocate in later years. He was very interesting. I asked him in my naive way at the age of 24, what is loyalism? And he said, start with an easy question. But basically what he said was, you know, the monarchy, to him, he wouldn't really, you know, care much for the monarchy, but it's symbolically important in terms of being a unifying force. Now, what was happening on Lanark Way a few weeks ago and in other parts of Northern Ireland, I don't think it's got anything to do with the monarchy. I don't think a lot of the people understand what the protocol really is. They just know, my reading of the situation would be that these young fellas know that something's wrong. There's a neurosis in the loyalist community that's been pervasive for 25 years. So these young fellas have picked up on that. It sort of filtered down to them. They might not be able to put their finger on what exactly is wrong, but they know that they are under threat, you know, but how they mobilize and react to that, obviously, politics would be the best medium for that. But I've heard it said a load of times, you know, they put it this way, you know, Sinn Féin got where they are through violence. So why should we not try that? But that's a really, that's a dead end.
It's asinine as well. It's like the lads down here who tell us that austerity got us out of the global financial crisis when it didn't. It was the global markets that did it. But there's a narrative that suits a simplistic version of. We all love history to be a straight line, and you know, as a historian, that there's lots of squiggles and lots of grey areas.
Well, that's it. And one of the things you hear a lot is loyalists saying Sinn Féin get everything, not Republicans get everything. Well, the simple fact of the matter is, Sinn Féin obviously had a strategy way back in the early 80s with the hunger strikes, that this was going to be the moment they'd seize on what had galvanized the Republican nationalist community to come together and start a political project. They saw that the war could be ended, or was going to come to an end, and there would have to be a political voice there. Whereas loyalists are always reacting, punching against the wall, and that's why it's been difficult. And then also, you look at people I would work with, like Billy Hutchinson and EUP, and they've been sort of pushed down by those who feel that they know better, the unionist parties. So you would have had, like, famously David Trimble would have said, I've basically, to paraphrase, he said, when you're sharing a platform with Billy Hutchinson, I've got an education, I can talk about this sort of thing. Whereas Billy Hutchinson was like, well, I've got a degree. And I think that's another point, people forget, people think about Davey Irvine and Gusty Spence, but, during those meetings with the three of them, with Billy Hutchinson, when they were going to Irish America, Billy was the only person in the room who actually had academic qualifications. So, it is asinine because it goes back to something Robert Niblock was saying to me the other week, where, if you tell somebody, and we've heard this, people feel like they're white trash, they feel like they don't have a stake in society, nothing's working for us. And as Robert said, well, when does it get to the stage where you say, fuck this, I'm going to prove you wrong? And when does a young person do that? Well, for me, it goes back to some of the, interviews I did during my PhD research where, and this is going back 15 years to 2006, I was talking to a guy called George Newell, who is a community education facilitator in East Belfast. And he said the problem was, now this is his perception at the time, was that to be a white working class Protestant male in Northern Ireland was to be the bottom of the rung. Because above you have the females, above you have ethnic minorities, and above that you have everything else. But he made an interesting point that I thought was really, really, really prescient. And it's about the language of the labour market, where he said that Tesco used to advertise for stock shelf stackers. But in working class Protestant areas back in 2006, the adverts were for replenishment officers. And he said that he had young fellas coming in, who didn't have an education, who could do that job. Maybe it would be a gateway to something better. And they were saying, fuck, a replenishment officer? That's very high powered. I couldn't do a job like that. And it's tragic, that people are being excluded from the labour market by the sort of language that's being used to dress up very menial jobs. So there's that disconnect as well. And these guys had fathers and grandfathers who built the Titanic and, were responsible for the industrial hub of Belfast. And now they're being expected to work in the service industry, which is, comes down to that whole idea of emasculation. And we've seen that happen in England as well.
And the US. You're very much explaining a polarized society in the US where there's a hierarchy of grievance, to tell you the truth, in many ways. It's this.
Absolutely.
And that kind of, that worries me when I hear you lay it out so well, that there's this kind of mentality that in order for others to get on, I have to have less, or that's the perception anyway. And that is a deep concern, especially when you have young people who, as you point out, might feel like they have nothing to lose.
Yeah.
And I think you make some really good points about how language is used to exclude and actually minimize these things. But sorry, Martin, I know I cut across you there.
Yeah, there's big parallels there with South Africa. I can see, even at standing so far back, there are huge parallels with South Africa, where a privileged group or a group that enjoyed privilege lost that privilege, and everybody was in the mixing pot then together. It was, and we've seen huge attainment from the people who were left behind originally. they have gone out and they've got huge attainment. And this, the same with the nationalist community up north. Education seems to be a huge big driver with the nationalist community. Yes. Why isn't that transferring through to the loyalist community?
That's absolutely right. You know, I'd say privilege, I mean, that's, again, it should be another podcast on its own. Privilege, certainly Protestant workers were privileged in terms of the working class, but in terms of the overall experience of the British working class, Protestant workers weren't better paid, they weren't as well paid as their counterparts in Britain. You know, and at the end of the day, how much privilege, and we can look at the industrial past through a rose-tinted lens, because how privileged was any industrial worker, really? And I think that's one of the things that maybe the Protestant working class never came to terms with, was that they were privileged in the context, of course, sectarian nature of Northern Irish society gave them a leg up, but were they actually as good off as they could have been? I mean, and that is the tragedy of the 1960s, that the civil rights campaign didn't bring people together to sort of go against Stormont, because it's only now you hear, or in the last 30 years, you hear loyalists sort of saying, well, look, Stormont never did anything for us. You know, and it is a tragedy that sectarianism came into it. The education thing's really important, because I come from a Catholic background. My parents, my dad was born in 1938. He lived in Larne, coastal town, County Antrim. We're obviously, a lot of the Brexit stuff's happening. So he talks about his dad. his dad was a, so this would have been back in the 1920s, 1930s. His dad shoveled coal down at Larne Harbour. And subsequently, you know, he was an alcoholic. He got out of that. Eventually, my dad became a pioneer. My dad wasn't an alcoholic. My grandfather was. And, you know, obviously, he was doing that awful work, shoveling coal. So, you know, likewise, my mum came from a slightly sort of lower middle class or working class background, where her dad worked as a printer in the Irish News. And the one thing that they were always told was, you have to get an education in this society. And then you had the Education Act in the 1940s, and, you know, that did really galvanize a new generation of which would become the Catholic middle class. But it was always, even in the 1990s, when I was going to grammar school, as it was always drummed into us, me and my brother, have to get an education, and that's, you know, in the modern era, that if you don't get an education, you won't get the sort of, like, you won't have the stake in society that you should have. And my parents are, my mum was involved in the Alliance Party when it was set up, which is a very different party to what I see now on Twitter. I mean, I think some of the orations of Alliance Party members are doing nothing but stirring the pot, really. Whereas my mum talks about going into both working class communities in 1971, 72, I'm being given a really hostile reception at the time. But, so education was a really important thing. I think, you know, in the Protestant working class community, you know, there was an educational culture, because you had people doing apprenticeships for trades. So there was a sort of learning culture. But with a guarantee of employment, obviously people did give up education a lot sooner than they would have done in maybe other cultures. And maybe we're seeing a blowback from that now, where you have that intergenerational experience that education isn't really important. But you have people... Sorry, go ahead. Sorry.
You know, that's a very good point, Garth. That's something I hadn't thought about before. When you have access to a workplace and it's pretty much guaranteed you're going to have access to a workplace, well, then you don't have to go to college.
The pipeline is available to you.
It's a very good point. I'm going to bring you back to Stormont a little. Mm-hmm. And we've seen now that Arlene Foster is going to be gone, and it looks like there's a bit of a competition for leadership of the DUP, but there is nobody there that we would, as you referred to, as a liberal loyalist. There is no liberal loyalism looking to be elected as leader of the DUP. And there is threats or rumours or procrastinations about actually crashing Stormont now at this stage. Do you think that's a possibility? And where do you think that's going to leave Northern Ireland?
I think collapsing Stormont would be an absolute disaster, unmitigated disaster. The devolution experiment hasn't really worked out, but it's better than what we had before, certainly. I mean, I remember I sort of came of age in 1998. So I remember, you know, what it was like before 1998. I remember what it was like up until the middle of the last decade. Belfast wasn't, I mean, I think of the Duke of York, for example, which is held up as a sort of, you know, poster of what Belfast is, you know, the new Belfast. Again, not to go off the point, but remember that Belfast that we see doesn't mean anything to the people who were out rioting and the people from that culture, because, and it's the same with the flag protests, you know, that whole campaign, we were back in Belfast and Snow Patrol came out and sort of, you know, we're trying to galvanise people. Those people don't feel it that, you know, when you're going and paying £6 for a pint in the Cathedral Quarter, that's not their society. That they've been pushed, that's polite society, and they've been pushed away.
They don't like Gant polo shirts and chicken wings at £25 a bowl, no?
Well, that's it. And you think, you know, people, you mean, see people wearing Fred Perry shirts and all now, and, you know, that's another thing that's been stolen from the working class. You know, that's just, but basically, I think it reminds me of something Sammy Wilson said to me when I was doing the PhD research. I was trying to look at why people did vote for the DUP and didn't vote for the, you know, the loyalist parties. And he said to me, and, you know, pretty abrasively, he said, the Protestant working class community are a very conservative community and the DUP represents them best. Now, I don't agree with that. And I think what you're seeing now, particularly with websites like Her Loyal Voice and Let's Talk Loyalism, you're seeing those more liberal working class Protestant loyalist voices coming to the fore. But when it comes to the crunch, the constitutional crunch, or the DUP have always been seen as a guarantor of the constitutional thing. Now, are they being seen as the guarantors now because they've completely messed up with this whole Brexit thing? And it's like choosing, it's in between a rock and a hard place with Boots and Donaldson. I think when it comes down to it, Donaldson would probably be more liberal. But, you know, at the end of the day, pragmatism has to win the day. But I don't know what the future is.
Can I quote you yourself when you said that basically when you talked about the more liberal mindsets and loyalism and the ideas around integration and actually moving forward together in a better way, you said yeah. They decommissioned mindsets as well as guns, but what yeah. say do they have in the political process now? And I think that sums that part up, because ultimately you've spoken about people who don't see themselves as represented in the politics, and yet when they go to it, the devil you know maybe better, you know, than the devil you don't, and the idea of the yeah. loss of identity, the idea this border and the sea, the protocol, people noise. Like, I suppose, how do I put this? Like, it's a centenary.
Yeah.
I mean, that's received in different ways in different communities. Our good friend Tig Hickey did a sketch on it yesterday, which I'm sure got under many loyalists' skin. But we look at it through that perspective. How do you feel 100 years on the actual? Like, it feels very much to me, and this is my opinion, that we're about a decade away from a border poll.
Yeah, and again, that's certainly when you talk to older loyalists about that border poll idea, their view is, okay, how are we going to be accommodated if there is United Ireland? Whereas I think younger people, and I'm not talking about all younger people, I'm talking about younger people like we saw rioting, I'm not sure they'd be as, you know, amenable to the idea. But it reminds me of something Paul Burgess said. Paul Burgess, good friend of mine, lecturer down in University College Cork. He's from Chankel originally. And he talked to the Sinn Féin Summer School a couple of years ago. And he put the ball in their park and said, look, Sinn Féin are the many Protestants, the most objectionable part of the United Ireland. So would they step aside to make a United Ireland happen? So that's the sort of scenario. Would Sinn Féin step aside to make it more palatable? I don't know. It's not
I think that's the
answer is no.
No, I think
exactly. Of course it is.
I think if you flipped it and said, would the DUP stand aside? And I think the answer would be a very firm no. It's not going to happen.
But again, sorry, Martin, I will let you come in. But Aoife Grace Moore made the point a few weeks ago, you know, hold dear to your NHS, hold dear to your to what we have, and a lot of that sort of stuff. There is, you're right to say, I don't like when you say, actually, how would we be accommodated? Because it would be, in effect, a new country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all of those things have to be and whether you have this issue with this idea like of loyalism as something that can't be accommodated, I just don't see that personally. But then again, I'm an optimist. Martin, go ahead. Sorry.
As a, we'll say, a progressive historian, Gareth, are you frustrated about where we are at the present moment in time?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously, I work with Billy Hutchinson quite closely on the book. I talked to David Irvine. And, you know, these are all people who have paramilitary pasts, but they're all also very, you know, forward-looking voices. And I also thought about the people in the background who never were heard of or given any credit, in terms of the UVF and the UDA. And I think that's what some people in those constituencies would look at. They'd look at the Assembly, and you'd see most constituencies represented. You'd see, you know, traditional unionism. You'd see protest unionism in terms of the DUP. You've got constitutional nationalism in the form of the SDLP. You've got republicanism / constitutional nationalism in the form of Sinn Féin. And importantly, Sinn Féin have built that up from, say, the sort of early days, and they've involved, you know, it's they've had that political project. They're two or three generations ahead of loyalism. So loyalists can't look at the Assembly and see clearly, you know, there's somebody I used to spend time with in Longcash, there's somebody I used to fight with. So there's no parallel there for them. And that's why, for me, it's a tragedy, because those people who went through the Gael protests came out as the most progressive voices, but they've been sidelined. And again, it goes back to that sort of idea of, you know, look, we're big, we're the main unionists, we're educated, we know more than you. We'll just give you a pat. It's a bit like Ian Paisley used to refer to the PUP as Mo Mullum's little pups. You know, and it's that idea of, you know, we'll give you a wee pat in the head, and, you know, and then I think there was a feeling, you know, among the PUP that after the agreement that they had been, I mean, they felt that they had been used as sort of, you know, leverage to get David Trimble into the process. He wavered, obviously, around decommissioning. And then there is that famous quote that, you know, Billy Hutchinson said that after the agreement, Blair had said that the chief constable would deal with loyalism and Blair would deal with Sinn Féin. You know, so again, it comes to that idea. And perception's a very important thing. I think perception, how a person feels about themselves, is important. I mean, you can tell people to change their minds and look at the reality or look at the processes. But if you wake up in the morning and you feel a certain way, it's very difficult to change that feeling. And if you feel like you're a criminal or white trash, yeah, you can get up and say, look, I'm not, and go and sort of, you know, prove people wrong. But, you know, it sort of gets into people's blood, maybe, and that's what we're living with at the moment, where people do feel like, you know, we're on the margins here. And you have people like in the PUP are still in existence. They're very marginal, with only, you know, three councillors. So having three councillors across Northern Ireland, you know, one in the Causeway and two in Belfast, isn't going to give you much leverage in political discussions. Now, if they got into the Assembly, that would be a different matter. But, recent history shows that people don't vote for them. I mean, I think people voted for David Irvine because of his charisma. You know, I would have, and I've talked to Billy about this, I have people in my family who would have, you know, thought David Irvine was a great fella, thought he was a great advocate, whereas when they look at Billy Hutchinson, they don't like him. Whereas I've got to know Billy very well over the years, and I regard him as a good friend. And, you know, he's a socialist. He wants those policies to work. He advocated same-sex marriage, you know, all those different types of things, and a woman's right to choose. But in Northern Ireland, as, you know, Smitty maybe alluded to, it's the loudest voice that wins. People who shout loudest. And you had that back in the days gone by, where you know, the Unionist Party would have sent a candidate around at election time on the back of a float with a big Union Jack, and just sort of people would have voted on that basis. Whereas the people who would have voted for the Labour-orientated, the Northern Ireland Labour Party, or the Independent, well, Shankill has a long history of voting in independence, so there is a sort of protest being there. But how do you galvanise that into a coherent political movement? It's going to be difficult at the moment, because what people want, and what people like Billy want, is a convention to bring all these unionist voices together to avoid the crisis that's being built around the protocol. But, you know, once unionism comes together, will it just subsume those independent voices again? So you're right back at the start, like you had at the start of the Troubles, where these voices were submerged into one big sort of behemoth, basically. So
It sounds very much like Northern Ireland could benefit from proportional representation. Now, I know that's a completely different podcast.
Yeah.
But it is, I think, for those North and South who have an interest in a peaceful island, no matter what the makeup of that island is, it is frustrating that we have gone from decommissioning to the Chuckle Brothers, and now we're back to, even though it's not exactly the same, we're back to what we would call, is it fair to say, recreational writing as a way of expressing frustration with the situation that exists?
I think it's important, you know, it's important, something I mentioned in the article, which, funny, I was talking to a few people, nobody picked up on it in the media, or certainly broadly, nobody picked up on it, but you look at David Campbell with the Loyalist Communities Council, and he made that famously inflammatory comment on Nolan, the Nolan show, where he said, we'll fight physically to preserve our status in the Union. And what I'm led to believe from talking to a few people, you know, the UVF leadership, was that he was called in and told never to say anything like that again. So there are restraining influences at force there in the UVF leadership. And now the UVF leadership would mainly be older men of a certain vintage who don't want to go back to those days. They certainly don't want the United Ireland, but they don't want to see, I mean, some of these are great-grandfathers now, that don't want young people getting involved in violence like they did. So, but it comes back to that grand old Duke of York thing. I mean, loyalists complained about that in the 1970s, and now you have figures like that again being pushed to the front, like David Campbell and David McNary, who are sort of saying, "No, we'll fight, we'll do this," but they won't fight. They'll be in their, you know, sitting room watching TV,
living in the community that they're pushing into the Troubles. That's the fact.
Exactly, and I've just mentioned one thing historically that came up in conversation with Robert Niblock. He talked to me about, you know, Bill Craig and the Vanguard movement, and we've talked about that and how inflammatory, but also how sort of that gave young people the feeling that, yeah, let's do this. We've been wanting to do this, and now the former Minister of Home Affairs is telling us we can do it. But then he saw another side to Bill Craig. He was on remand from prison, and Gusty Spence sent him up to Bill Craig's house in East Belfast or South Belfast, and asked him to tell Bill Craig about the conditions that loyalists were in Longcash, because the conditions for both sides, Republicans and loyalists, were notoriously bad, with, you know, rats and freezing temperatures during the winter and all damp and all sorts in the prison. And Robert went up to Bill Craig, went into the house, and Bill Craig was absolutely stoicious, drunk, and didn't care what Robert was saying. He didn't care about the loyalists who were in jail. So again, it's all these optics and what people say to get votes and make people feel that, yeah, we'll defend loyalism. But in reality, they haven't done a hand's turn as a parliament goes here, you know, for the actual cause that they're talking about. And, you know, that's a tragedy. Young working class men have gone to jail and will go to jail in the future if this escalates. And it'll be the politicians who brought them out onto the streets who will disown them, clean their hands off them. And this is a horrible hamster wheel that we're on, where history keeps repeating itself and there's no way of moving forward. We're moving sideways.
I have to agree.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead, Gareth.
So republicanism, it goes back to that, you know, sort of people say Republicans get everything. Well, they put in the hard work, they put in the legwork to build a strategy. I mean, you look at the two roads, and I know the Falls quite well. My partner from Twinbrook originally, And her family, the family are from Andersonstown. So I'd be up and down there quite a lot over the last number of years. And I spent a hell of a lot of time on the Shankill. You know, and I've seen the two communities side by side. There is the same issues in both communities. But crucially, West Belfast and Sinn Féin have been better at extending the hand of friendship internationally. And that's why we have things like Féile Festival. And you have, you know, top-class, world-class acts coming in. Well, maybe not world-class acts, but world-class speakers, because Pumpkin Boys Own and stuff is world-class. But you have, you know, you have, like, speakers coming over, intellectual debates, which, you know, obviously they do invite loyalists. One of the panels I was at was ex-loyalist prisoners, Billy Hutchinson, Robert Niblock, William Mitchell, Eve Campbell, and Tony Novotel, Professor Tony Novotel from Pittsburgh. But there is no strategy in loyalism, so it's that seems to work. So it seems to be fated to that constant punching against the wall, keeping your back against the wall. It's, I mean, I used this metaphor recently where myself and Robert Niblock have done this thing in the past called Belts and Boots, the Bombs and Bullets, where we have tried to go out with the play that he wrote about the Tartan Gangs and the poetry that he's written about that early period, where he's been very self-reflective. And then with my sort of more academic research, although I wouldn't regard myself as an academic anymore, you know, that historical research, and we've tried to go out and tell people in places like Portadown, East Belfast and the Shankill, look, if you think history's being rewritten by Republicans, tell your story before it's too late. And people say, oh yeah, no, we'll definitely do that, and then there's no buy-in from it. You have a book like More Meekly Serve My Time, written by loyalist or Republican prisoners, and Lawrence McCune was obviously pivotal in that, but you have no similar thing in the loyalist side. So it's a constant sort of, you know, the metaphor I used was when we were doing that and people weren't responding. Was for me, loyalism seems to be like, the only metaphor I could use was like a team that's been relegated, you know, like on a record number of, you know, I think I'm a Nottingham Forest fan, so I'm going to use the example of Derby County back when they were in the Premiership. The worst team in Premiership history, they were relegated in something like February or March. So they had tons of games to play, the obligation to play those games. So it's like playing out time, you're kicking out time until the inevitable comes and your season's over. And for me, it's a horrible thing to think about, but that's what loyalism sometimes feels like, that, you know, you have these bursts of energy that you see with Billy Hutchinson and the PUP and Let's Talk Loyalism and Her Loyal Voice. But also the general feeling seems to be one of neurosis and sort of feeling we're never going to win, we're defending this constantly, we're weary, nobody likes us, we don't get anything. And where does it go? Where does it go? I honestly, and I said this recently, I don't know what the answer is anymore. I really don't know what the future holds. But and I think it doesn't look good.
And I think that applies to us all. I think we all don't know where this is going. Garth, look, thank you very much for coming on this morning and having this chat with us. It's always good to get voices on the ground. I mean, we can have our own hot takes, as Tony says, from down south, but our hot takes aren't worth a damn. You know, you have to walk a mile in the shoes of somebody who's up there. So thank you very much for coming on and explaining this.
Thanks for listening to my rantings and ravings.
Actually, you know, that the frustration does come true, Garth. And unfortunately, it's come true in everybody we've spoken to, be it Kula, be it Emma, be it Brian, be it yourself. It's certainly a frustration there that there is a path to a better future for young people involved and for across the island in different ways, but we just have this reticence. And as you said, I think it's important that we're going to continue to cover it, and we'll hope to come back to you again in the next little while. No, and we really appreciate it. Listen, folks, we'll be back in your feed shortly. I think we've Niall Sargent on his cost of carbon coming up, so keep an eye out for that. But thank you so much. I really did enjoy that, even though my heart goes, you did seem the frustration was tangible.
It's because I've spent so many years, you know, and again, I'm not from that community, so it's weird that, but at the end of the day, I live in this country, so you want a better future for everybody, and it includes loyalists, it has to, and you know, it's just, I see how much people care in those communities, trying to make a difference, and I see how they come up against so many obstacles, so yeah, it does make me angry to see people's good work being ignored and, you know,
Garrett Mulvenna. You can find you at gmulvenna1980 on Twitter. Go, there's some good threads up there. You can find his blog and check out his podcast as well. And we will talk to you all soon. Take care. Bye bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony.